Imagine you're standing like right in front of a massive towering concert speaker.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when the music is blaring, you literally feel it in your chest. The bass is violently shaking your ribs. There is just absolutely no ignoring it.
Right, it's a completely full-body physiological experience. It forcibly alters your perception of the physical space you're in.
Exactly. But what if you take the volume knob on that exact same sound system and you turn it all the way down to a one?
Okay.
You can't actually hear the music anymore. The room seems, perfectly quiet. But if you walk up and put your bare hand on that speaker cone, you can still feel this microscopic, invisible vibration.
Yeah, that tiny hum.
Right. And the question is that tiny vibration doing anything to the room? Or I guess more importantly, is it doing anything to
I love that.
you?
It's the difference between a systemic shock to the nervous system and, well, a subtle biological hum.
Welcome to today's deep dive. Since you follow the space, you already know we are looking at an incredibly pervasive modern phenomenon today. It has rapidly jumped from being this secretive Silicon Valley productivity biohack into a truly mainstream global practice.
It really has. It's everywhere now.
It is. We are analyzing the science of microdosing psilocybin, and we're pulling from this highly comprehensive article out of the OOTW Journal titled Microdosing Psilocybin: What the Science Actually Says.
Which is a crucial read because, I mean, the public discourse surrounding this is so heavily polarized right
Oh,
now.
completely.
You have advocates who view this as some flawless panacea for human optimization and mental health. And then conversely, you have skeptics who just dismiss it entirely as an elaborate, trendy placebo. They argue that if you can't feel a profound altered state, then nothing of pharmacological value is happening at all.
Right. So our mission today is to cut right through both the uncritical hype and that stubborn dismissal. We are going to look at the hard, peer-reviewed neuroscience and the clinical trials to really understand what happens when millions of people just decide to experiment on their own brains.
Which is exactly what's happening.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. Because to parse the clinical data, we first have to isolate the strict pharmacological baseline. The prefix micro gets thrown around casually, but in the literature, it has a very rigid definition.
Yeah, the scientific community relies heavily on this concept of a subperceptual dose.
Right.
It has to be an amount of the molecule that produces measurable pharmacological effects at the cellular level. But, and this is key, it is entirely insufficient to produce hallucinations, sensory alterations, or really any impairment of your ordinary daily functioning.
So if the walls are breathing during your morning commute, that is no longer a microdose.
Exactly, you've crossed the line.
Let's put the hard clinical numbers to that baseline for you. When the literature references a microdose of dried psilocybin mushrooms, specifically Psilocybe cubensis, which is the most widely used, the parameter is 0.05 to 0.3 grams.
Which is tiny.
It is, and translating that organic material into pure isolated psilocybin, the target is a microscopic 1 to 3 milligrams.
To give you some context on that, standard therapeutic doses used in the big clinical psychedelic trials for major depression, the ones designed to induce a profound mystical ego dissolving
It's a
experience.
macrodoses.
Right. Those are typically around 25 milligrams of pure psilocybin. So a microdose is roughly 1/10 to 1/20 of that full perceptual threshold.
Wow.
That subperceptual line is a non-negotiable biological boundary in the research.
And the methodology of taking it is just as strict. The users aren't just ingesting this daily, like a standard vitamin C supplement or something. The clinical trials structure their research around very specific timing schedules.
Yes, the protocols.
Yeah. The most heavily researched protocol is the Phadimen protocol, developed by James Phadimen. And the cycle is really rigid. Day one involves taking the subperceptual dose. Day two is a transition day with no dose. Day three is a normal baseline day, again with no dose. And then the cycle repeats, usually sustained for a period of 4 to 8 weeks.
And the pharmacology behind why this specific spacing exists is entirely rooted in how the brain defends its own equilibrium.
Actually, think about the Phadimen protocol, like physical training and muscle recovery.
Oh, that's a good way to look at it.
Right. If you go to the gym and overload your biceps with heavy lifting, you don't go back the very next day and execute the exact same heavy workout. Your muscle fibers literally require dedicated rest days to synthesize protein, rebuild, and physically adapt.
Right, you need recovery.
Exactly. If you deny the body that rest, you just get diminishing returns and eventually systemic fatigue. And the neurochemistry of psilocybin operates on a very similar requirement for recovery. Because when the molecule enters the brain, it aggressively binds to the 5-HT2A serotonin receptors.
Yeah, and the brain is constantly striving for homeostasis. So when those 5-HT2A receptors are suddenly stimulated by an exogenous compound, even at that tiny 1 to 3 milligram dose, the neurons initiate this defensive process called downregulation.
They pull back.
Exactly. The receptors physically retreat from the surface of the cell membrane to avoid being continuously overstimulated.
Wow.
So if you were to ingest a microdose every single morning, by day 3 or 4, the psilocybin molecules would have drastically fewer available receptors to actually bind to.
You build rapid receptor tolerance.
Exactly. Those 2 consecutive rest days in the Phadimen protocol are biologically mandatory. They allow the receptors sufficient time to migrate back to the cell surface and just reset to their baseline sensitivity.
That makes so much sense. The text also outlines a secondary methodology, though, called the Stamets protocol, conceptualized by mycologist Paul Stamets. The cadence here shifts to 5 consecutive days of dosing, followed by 2 days of rest.
Right, a very different rhythm.
Very different. But the critical difference is the introduction of a nootropic stack. The psilocybin is combined with lion's mane mushroom, which independently stimulates nerve growth factor, and niacin, which is just vitamin B3.
The niacin flush.
Yeah. The mechanism of the niacin is intentional vasodilation. It expands the blood vessels, causing this flush, warm, physiological reaction. And theoretically, this acts as a delivery mechanism to basically push the neurogenic compounds deeper into the peripheral nervous system.
Interesting approach.
It is. The OOTW text notes this stack is highly popular among users, but it currently lacks the sheer volume of controlled clinical trials applied to the Phadimen schedule.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the reason this subperceptual baseline is so vital scientifically is that it forces a massive paradigm shift in neurobiology.
How so?
Well, for decades, the prevailing assumption was that psychedelics only yielded therapeutic benefits because the user endured a profound, conscious, psychological breakthrough.
Right, the trip itself was the medicine.
Exactly. But if a subject is dosing entirely below the threshold of feeling an altered state, researchers are suddenly challenged to prove that purely physical, pharmacological changes are occurring in the hardware of the brain, completely independent of the subject's conscious experience.
Action without perception. So if the dose is too small to consciously feel, we have to look directly at the hardware. Does this 1 to 3 milligram whisper of a dose actually physically alter the brain's architecture, or is it biologically inert?
The cellular data confirms it definitely actively alters the brain.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Positron emission tomography, or PET scans, which use radioactive tracers to visualize metabolic processes and receptor binding, in real time, they show definitive action.
Okay, what are they seeing?
Well, the 5-HT2A receptors are highly concentrated in the pyramidal neurons of the prefrontal cortex. That's essentially the brain's command center for complex cognitive behavior, personality expression, decision-making,
Too important stuff.
All right. And PET imaging demonstrates that even at subperceptual microdose levels, the psilocybin molecule successfully occupies these receptors. It doesn't bind with enough volume to trigger the cascading electrical storm of a full hallucination, but it binds enough to modulate cortical excitability.
It changes the electrical threshold.
Yes. It fundamentally alters how sensory information is processed by changing the threshold required for neurons to fire.
And the physical changes extend far beyond just basic receptor binding, which is crazy. The OETW article highlights a really comprehensive 2023 study by Cameron and colleagues that focuses on structural neuroplasticity.
The TRKB study.
Yes. The research centers on the TRKB receptor. This is the primary receptor for brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. Now, rather than using the old cliche of calling BDNF brain fertilizer, a much more accurate way to understand this mechanism is to picture a city's infrastructure.
I like this.
BDNF basically acts like a crew installing high-speed fiber optic cables between existing slow dirt roads. It physically broadens and reinforces the structural connections between neurons, so electrical signals can travel faster and just far more efficiently.
What's fascinating here is that the 2023 Cameron study proved psilocybin directly binds to this TRKB neuroplasticity receptor completely independently of the 5-HT2A serotonin receptor.
Wait, really? Independent of it?
Yes. The hallucinogenic effects of psilocybin require a massive volume of the drug to cross a specific receptor threshold. But the TRKB binding operates on a simple dose response curve. So even a minuscule microdose initiates the promotion of dendritic growth.
That is wild.
The neurons actively sprout new physical branches, forming novel structural connections. The brain is physically rewiring its own hardware, creating actual biological markers of neuroplasticity, all while the user remains completely sober.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Let's examine the default mode network, the DMN, because high-dose clinical trials show that heavy psychedelic use temporarily shatters the connectivity of the DMN.
Right. It takes it totally offline.
And this network is the neurological seat of the narrative self. It's responsible for rumination, self-reflection, constantly projecting into the past and future. Heavy doses dissolve it. But the text indicates that microdoses merely produce a subtle dampening of its overactivity. I have to challenge this concept a bit.
Go for it.
If the default mode network isn't fully dissolving, how does this subtle dampening actually translate to the conscious experience of a person who is, you know, just sitting at their office desk reviewing a spreadsheet?
That is a great question. The phenomenological translation is subtle, but it's profound. When the DMN is hyperactive, which is actually a primary neurological hallmark of clinical depression and severe anxiety disorders, the brain is allocating massive amounts of energy to intrusive self-referential simulations.
Like overthinking everything.
Exactly. Mm. The internal monologue is constantly running threat assessments. Am I performing this task correctly? What did my manager imply in that meeting? Am I falling behind?
Exhausting.
It is. So when a microdose subtly dampens the excitability of that specific network, the user doesn't experience the ego death of a macrodose. What they experience is a sudden liberation of attentional bandwidth.
The internal noise floor basically just drops.
Yes. The brain stops burning 40% of its metabolic energy running an anxious background simulation of the self. And that freed cognitive energy becomes instantly available for outward focus.
The spreadsheet.
The spreadsheet.
Yeah.
The complex coding problem. The nuanced conversation with a colleague. Users frequently describe this not as feeling intoxicated, but as feeling unburdened or just less stuck in their own internal narrative loops.
Okay, so the theoretical biology is sound. The PE scans confirm receptor occupancy. The molecular studies confirm dendritic growth via TRKB. But when researchers take this out of the petri dish and test it in living, breathing humans, the clinical results create this fascinating collision between objective pharmacology and the overwhelming power of human expectancy.
Oh, the placebo effect.
We have to analyze the clinical trials and specifically the placebo problem.
This intersection is where the clinical literature becomes incredibly complex, honestly.
Yeah.
Because in 2019, Polito and Stevenson conducted a naturalistic observational study involving 98 participants.
Okay.
These individuals were already engaging in microdosing protocols independently. The researchers simply tracked their psychological metrics over time, and the self-reported results were aggressively positive. They showed statistically significant reductions in baseline depression, chronic stress, daily distractibility.
But there's a catch, right?
A big one. The study design lacked a placebo control group.
Which is a problem. Because without a placebo group, researchers cannot mathematically isolate whether the psilocybin molecule actually repaired the neurological pathways or if the sheer powerful belief that the molecule would work just triggered the brain's own endogenous healing mechanisms.
Exactly. You can't untangle them.
So to solve this, a research team at Imperial College London, led by Bilas Szigeti in 2021, engineered this absolutely ingenious, self-blinding citizen science study.
This study is legendary.
It's so cool. They recruited 191 participants who set up an elaborate system in their own homes. They packed opaque capsules with active mushroom powder and then identical capsules with a biologically inert dummy powder.
Right.
They placed these into envelopes marked with specialized QR codes, randomized them following strict instructions, and effectively blinded themselves. So on any given day of the protocol, the participant genuinely possessed zero conscious knowledge of whether they were swallowing an active microdose or an empty placebo.
Methodologically, that was a breakthrough, because blinding a traditional psychedelic trial is notoriously impossible.
Right, because you trip.
Exactly. If a clinician administers 25 milligrams of psilocybin, the subject knows within 45 minutes if they receive the active drug or the placebo. The blinding is broken immediately. But because microdosing targets a strictly subperceptual threshold, researchers could successfully maintain the blind for weeks.
But the published results of that 2021 self-blinding study were a massive disruption to the microdosing community.
Oh, huge.
Because both cohorts, the individuals consistently taking the active psilocybin and the individuals taking the empty placebo capsules, recorded highly significant sustained improvements in overall well-being, depressive symptoms, and anxiety metrics over the 4 weeks.
They both got better.
Yes. When analyzing the primary subjective measures of mental health, the active pharmacological dose did not significantly outperform the empty capsules. The placebo group experienced the exact same psychological relief.
Yeah, that data point upset a lot of people.
So what does this all mean? Does this specific Sagetti study provide definitive proof that microdosing is ultimately just a glorified trendy sugar pill?
Well, it is a critical error in scientific literacy to jump to that conclusion.
Okay, why?
The data does not prove that microdosing is biologically inert. It proves that the psychological force of expectancy is capable of generating massive shifts in subjective well-being. Both groups improved dramatically because both groups deeply believed they were taking a powerful intervention.
Yeah.
However, the data revealed a crucial divergence. The cohort taking the active psilocybin microdose actually did statistically outperform the placebo group on objective psychomotor cognitive measures.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, these are complex tasks requiring active, rapid brain-body coordination and spatial processing. So the molecule was demonstrably enhancing cognitive hardware, but the subjective emotional relief was heavily, heavily driven by the mind's anticipation of healing.
Okay, that makes sense. Sagetti's team actually followed up that citizen science project in 2023 with a tightly controlled clinical randomized controlled trial involving 34 patients diagnosed with depression.
Right, moving into the clinic.
Yeah, and in this clinical setting, the active psilocybin cohort demonstrated significantly greater reductions in depressive symptoms at the four-week mark. So in the short term, the drug clearly beat the placebo.
But then what happened?
Well, as the trial extended out to the eight-week mark, the statistical gap narrowed. The placebo group's symptoms continued to steadily improve until they effectively caught up to the active group's baseline.
And this timeline perfectly isolates the primary scientific hurdle facing psychedelic medicine today. The cellular mechanisms of neuroplasticity are undeniable. The structural changes to the neurons are physically occurring.
We saw that with TRKB.
Exactly. The immense challenge is mathematically untangling the molecule's pharmacological work from the mind's psychological expectancy in a clinical setting. They operate as a deeply, deeply entangled system.
Well, placebo effects notwithstanding, when researchers survey massive populations of real-world users, they document incredibly consistent impacts. But because this practice is spreading exponentially outside of controlled clinical supervision, analyzing the actual biological risks is mandatory for us today. The word micro does not equate to harmless.
Not at all. Framing a powerful serotonergic modulator as some benign everyday wellness supplement is a dangerous mischaracterization of the pharmacology.
So looking at the macro data on benefits first, a 2019 survey conducted by Anderson and colleagues aggregated data from over 1,100 active users spanning 59 countries, and the self-reported cognitive boosts were substantial.
What were the numbers?
26.6% of respondents reported significantly improved mood, 14.8% reported enhanced focus, and 12.9% reported elevated creativity.
Wow.
Yeah, and a separate 2018 study by Prokaskova objectively measured that creative enhancement. The data showed measurable improvements in both convergent thinking, which is the cognitive process of deducing the single correct solution to a logical problem, and divergent thinking, which is the brain's ability to rapidly generate multiple out-of-the-box conceptual solutions.
And reviewing the qualitative reports, users consistently utilize this phrase, emotional fluidity.
Emotional fluidity.
Yeah. They are not reporting an artificial sustained state of euphoria. They report the sudden capability to experience a wider, more volatile range of human emotions without becoming psychologically paralyzed by them.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. And this phenomenological report aligns flawlessly with the TRKB neuroplasticity data. A brain that is actively building new physical synaptic connections is, by definition, a more flexible, adaptable processing system.
But the clinical literature heavily emphasizes the adverse effects, too. The most consistently reported negative outcome impacting up to 6.7% of users in the Anderson survey is severe anxiety amplification.
Yes, and the mechanism behind this adverse reaction is directly tied back to those 5-HT2A receptors.
How so?
Stimulating these receptors fundamentally increases overall cortical arousal and sensory gating. Basically, the brain allows more sensory data to pass through its filter.
Oh.
For an individual in a stable environment, that pharmacological shift is experienced as laser-sharp focus and presence. But if an individual has a baseline anxiety disorder or is currently enduring a highly stressful life circumstance, that heightened neurological sensitivity causes the external data to become completely overwhelming.
It's too much.
Right. It acts as an amplifier for whatever psychological state is already present. So it rapidly escalates baseline stress into severe physiological panic.
Oh, wow. and the physical risks require just as much scrutiny. The OOTW text details a highly specific cardiac risk involving the 5-HTTB receptor.
Oh, yes, the cardiac valves.
Yes. These specific serotonin receptors are densely located on the cellular surface of human cardiac valves. In the broader field of pharmacology, we know that chronic, sustained activation of the 5-HT2B receptor initiates cellular proliferation, which leads directly to valvular heart disease.
Now, at the microgram dosage levels we are discussing, the cumulative biological load placed on the cardiac tissue is theoretically very low.
Theoretically.
Right. However, this physiological mechanism is precisely why the Fadiman protocol's mandatory rest days are critical. If a user dismisses the clinical protocols and elects to ingest higher doses every single day for months or years, they're effectively overriding their body's recovery system and taking a profound, entirely unmapped cardiovascular risk.
Yeah, that is terrifying. And the psychological contraindications in the literature are absolute. The text is unambiguous about this. Microdosing, even at subperceptual levels, is strictly contraindicated for any individual with a personal or familial history of schizophrenia, bipolar eye disorder, or any psychotic features.
This raises an important question regarding public health communication. You know, the casual branding of microdosing as a gentle productivity hack obscures the biological reality that it is a potent serotonergic intervention.
Right. It's a real drug.
Exactly. In neurologically vulnerable populations, even a microscopic pharmacological push can be sufficient to breach the threshold and trigger severe cascading psychotic symptoms.
The final layer of risk involves dangerous pharmacological interactions. If a user is actively prescribed SSRI or SNRI antidepressants, these medications compete for the very same receptors, which generally results in a significant blunting or total nullification of the psilocybin's effects.
Basically canceling it out.
Yeah. And if a user is prescribed an MAOI monoamine oxidase inhibitors, which fundamentally stop the brain's enzymes from clearing out excess serotonin, introducing psilocybin can trigger serotonin syndrome.
Which is incredibly dangerous.
It is. It overloads the receptors to a highly toxic, potentially fatal level. Furthermore, combining any psychedelic compound with prescribed lithium dramatically lowers the brain's seizure threshold, carrying a highly documented risk of inducing severe neurological seizures. The hardware is incredibly delicate.
It really is. You are introducing an exogenous neuromodulator into a highly complex, delicately balanced neurochemical ecosystem. It requires an immense degree of clinical respect.
Absolutely. So, synthesizing all the clinical data for you, microdosing psilocybin is undeniably a complex, entangled biological and psychological event. You have verifiable subthreshold pharmacology, the TRKB receptor binding, the structural dendritic growth, the subtle electrical dampening of the default mode network.
All happening under the hood.
Right. And all of that physical machinery is layered directly on top of a highly structured, intentional psychological ritual.
Millions of individuals are currently executing a massive, entirely uncontrolled global trial on their own nervous system.
It's wild to think about.
It is. And the scientific community is aggressively working to catch up. You know, structuring the rigorous placebo-controlled trials necessary to evaluate this for conditions like treatment-resistant ADHD and major depression, cluster headaches, too.
Oh, right.
But perhaps the most profound outcome of this entire cultural phenomenon is that it is forcing neuroscientists to rethink the rigid historical boundary drawn between a strict pharmacological intervention and a dedicated mindfulness practice.
I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. The OOTW journal text notes that aggressively obsessing over the question, is it purely pharmacology or is it purely placebo, might actually be missing the broader revelation here.
How so?
Well, consider the rigorous demands that microdosing places on a user. It requires the physical ritual of measuring a dose. It requires setting a clear daily intention for your own behavior. It requires deeply, quietly monitoring your own mental state throughout the entire day to document subtle psychological shifts.
It demands an extraordinary level of active, conscious participation in the architecture of your own well-being.
Exactly. If the sheer psychological ritual of preparing that dose and aggressively tuning into the frequency of your own mind produces profound, measurable neurological benefits, even in the cases where a person is blindly taking an empty dummy capsule, what does that suggest about the rest of your life?
That is a great point.
What other mundane daily habits could physically rewire the structural hardware of your brain for the better if you simply chose to treat them with the exact same level of scientific reverence and intention?
It indicates that the human nervous system is far more capable of structural self-repair than we currently understand, provided it's given the correct psychological framework.
So think back to that massive concert speaker. You don't always need the deafening, room-shaking bass drop to alter the physical energy of the space. Sometimes you just need to place your hand on the cone, turn the volume down to a 1, and pay incredibly close attention to the vibration.